So, good morning to all. I think we should start because it's 9:05. So we start with Gary Gibbons' last lecture. And okay, so let's go.
Thank you. Well, this is my last lecture, and it's on a slightly different topic from the ones that I've spoken about so far. The title is Matrix Cosmology, and it's a set of rather speculative ideas about how to combine the matrix model with cosmology. Before I start, I think I should pause to thank, on behalf probably of all of the speakers, the organizers for organizing this splendid conference with immaculate precision, going quite beyond the calls of duty by arranging for the defeat of Portugal's traditional enemies, the French and the Spanish. I can only see one mistake. They forgot about Portugal's oldest ally, the English, and somehow managed to defeat the English as well. But we'll forgive that. Okay, let's start by way of motivation, by way of telling you what I'm going to talk about. Okay, I'm going to start by motivation, which will be especially important since it's a slightly unfamiliar topic. I'm going to recall the relationship between matrices and D0 particles. I'm going to tell you something about classical matrix theory, mentioning on the way some interesting properties of classical matrix theory involving chaos. And then I'm going to talk about the cosmology of D0 brains. And at the end, I should be relating this to a class of metrics written down by Mackie and Shirashi many years ago, which are time-dependent supergravity solutions. Because they're time-dependent, they cannot be supersymmetric, at least superficially. But they are interesting time-dependent backgrounds for string theory and other things, and that's in fact a connection with what I'm doing. But interestingly enough, if you lift them to 11 dimensions, they become time-independent and supersymmetric. So from one point of view, this is a study of time-dependent cosmological-style backgrounds in supergravity theory and string theory. Okay, well, let me say a bit more about the motivation. Now, of course, we all accept, I think, that the foundations of string theory or M theory, whatever we call the subject, are as yet not completely clear. We don't have a simple set of equations which are supposed to govern everything that we do, analogous to the Einstein equations or the equations of quantum field theory. But one proposal, an influential proposal, is the matrix model of Banks, Fischler, I think it should be SS, shouldn't it? Anyhow, which is claimed to provide a complete quantum mechanical description of M theory. Now, what I find interesting about this model is that it replaces conventional space-time concepts with new concepts, such as, in the case of classical space-time, we have commuting coordinates. In this model, it's a theory with non-commuting coordinates, for example. And one of, I think, of the challenges of understanding the foundations of M theory is that we all believe that something will replace our familiar space-time ideas, but we don't actually know precisely what it is. And so one interesting project is to try to take a theory which is fundamentally not much like a space-time and try to translate our ideas of space-time, and in particular cosmology, in that context. And it's in that setting, that, or with that motivation, that I've embarked on this project, which is ongoing and as yet incomplete work with Dan Friedman and Martin Schnabel. I began it at MIT a few months ago. Now, if you believe that this was a fundamental proposal, then you would be surely convinced that this should say something about cosmology. Okay, it's supposed to be a theory of everything, and in particular of the structure of the universe. And in that context, it should surely be able to tell us something about notions such as the wave function of the universe. We know how to deal with the wave function of the universe at the semi-classical level. There's been a great deal of work on that topic. But what the wave function of the universe really is at a fundamental quantum mechanical level is as yet unclear. But the theory that we've been presented with here is supposed to be a fundamental quantum mechanical theory. And if it's a fundamental quantum mechanical theory, it should allow us to discuss the wave function of the universe. So in this lecture, what I'm going to present are extremely rudimentary and preliminary ideas which are directed towards this end. And as I said, this is work in progress with Dan Friedman, Martin Schnabel, and there was some early interaction with Stefan Alexander. Now, as far as I know, this idea has not been exploited at all in the literature, with the exception of a very early paper of Alvarez and Meeson, which I'll refer to later. It is true that there are many papers nowadays on two-dimensional matrix models, time-dependent backgrounds in string theory, but what I'm going to present is different from that. I mean, of course, it's linked, there's a similar motivation, but it is not the same thing. Okay, well, I'm going to start by reminding you about the relationship between matrices and D0 particles. So for some, this will be a review, and for others, perhaps slightly new. So in this matrix model of BFSS, the basic idea is it's based on n by n Hermitian matrices, the quantum mechanics, in fact, of n by n Hermitian matrices, and you take the limit n goes to infinity. So the tricky bit is, of course, taking the limit n goes to infinity. And when one says this is a proposal, what one's actually saying is that there ought to be some way of taking the limit n goes to infinity such that you get something out of it. This is linked. This model can be thought of in a variety of ways, one of which it goes back to the work of Hoppe, Nicolai, and DeWitt, who took the 11-dimensional supermembrane and regularized it. And if you do that, then you land up with the quantum mechanics of these matrices, indicated in a little bit more detail shortly. The basic motivation and procedure of these authors was, on the one hand, different. What they did was to consider D0 particles, and because it's a supersymmetric system, these are D0 particles moving in 10 dimensions, you've got a pretty much unique supersymmetric system. You've got supersymmetric Young-Mills with a gauge group UN, fermions in the adjoint, and then if you do a dimensional reduction to one time dimension, the matrices AI, which are the transverse pieces of the the algebra-valued one-forms, i.e. Hermitian matrices, where I runs from 1 to 9, become these x's, the positions. So that's a description of the theory, roughly speaking. If you think of the membrane in light cone gauge, you can make contact with this. If you fix the pass the light cone gauge, as these authors did, the residual gauge symmetry is the area preserving diffeomorphisms of a surface, the surface of the membrane. This is an analog in string theory of the Virasoro group, which is, that's the algebra of the diffeomorphism of a circle. That's the residual gauge symmetry in some sense of the string in light cone gauge. Here, the residual gauge symmetry is the area preserving maps of a surface, which you may also think of as canonical transformations or symplectomorphisms of a two-dimensional surface. And the Lie algebra of such area-preserving maps is, in some sense, the same as the limit of the Lie algebra of UN. So you're led to this model in a fairly unique fashion. The two lines of thought converged when that model was constructed. So we want to think of the XIs as representing non-commuting coordinates associated to a collection of n D0 brains. The diagonal matrices correspond to n supersymmetric or BPS D0 particles whose world lines are the ends of F strings. So that's one way to think about this point of view. Now, if we have a cluster of D0 particles, a large number, then we can consider a heavy system. Gravity should be important, and clusters of D0 particles are therefore described by a supergravity action, and the relevant supergravity action is the 10-dimensional type 2A supergravity. And the D0 particles can indeed be thought of as a solution of that theory. The D0 particles are, in actual fact, solutions I mean, the BPS solutions associated to them in this limit are electrically charged extreme black hole solutions. I won't write down the formulae. But the RR charge, the Ramon-Ramon charge in string theory terms, comes from a dimensional reduction of 11-dimensional supergravity. So they are, if you like, a kind of Kaluza-Klein black hole obtained from 11 dimensions. If you lift that solution up to 11 dimensions, which you can because the type 2A comes from reduction from 11 dimensions, the solution you get is a particular form of a PP wave in 11 dimensions, but it's a PP wave with no time dependence in 11 dimensions. This is a quite general principle. If you take PP waves in one dimension and then PP waves in a certain dimension reduced by one, if the PP wave has a profile function which is independent of retarded time, it would look like a bunch of particles, supersymmetric particles in the lower dimensional space. So that also works for five-dimensional theory. So that's what D0 particles are. What about classical matrix theory? Well, classical matrix theory has some classical equations of motion, and the classical equations of motion take this form. Forget the right-hand side for the time being. Put that little lambda equals zero. Then you can look at this as the reduction of Yang-Mills. This is a commutator of a commutator. The potential that you get for this system is, in fact, the square of the commutator of the matrices. And these are just precisely the Yang-Mills equations. Now, the standard matrix theory has zero on the right-hand side. But it's possible to add something on the right-hand side. And the thing you can add on the right-hand side has two different interpretations. Because we're interested in cosmology, I like to think of it as a cosmological term. But if you are a matrix theory person, you can also think of it as a mass term. If you have a massive matrix model, then you'll have a quadratic term in your potential, and it will give rise to this term coming in here. Now, the sign of this term will depend upon the sign of the mass. I'll say something about that shortly. But its interpretation as a cosmological term appears in a paper of Gao some time ago. And his argument is a rather neat argument, which I will go over now, because it's very closely related to the topic of this talk. If lambda is equal to zero, this is, of course, a standard Newtonian theory, and thus has Galilean invariance. It's not a great thing, but it has Galilean invariance. It's not relativistic. Indeed, that Galilean invariance is what you would expect, because Galilean invariance is the residual symmetry of any system in light cone gauge. If you add this term here, you break Galilean invariance, but actually, you don't break all symmetries. Actually, Galilean invariance becomes transmuted to a symmetry called Newton-Hooke invariance. Now, Newton-Hooke invariance is not a widely appreciated symmetry. What it is the analog for the de Sitter group of the Galilean group for the Poincaré group. Now, we all know that the Galilean group emerges as the limit of the Poincaré group when you take the velocity of light to infinity. It's a contraction of the Wigner-Ionio type. Now, you could ask yourself purely abstractly, and of course it's been done in the past, what is the Newtonian limit of the de Sitter group? There is a Newtonian limit. You have to take the velocity of light to infinity. You actually have to do something slightly more subtle. You have to take the cosmological constant to zero in just such a way that this combination is finite. Now, in my way of thinking things, this lambda should be a 1 over length squared. So this is a 1 over time squared. So you get a time coming in your theory. And if you look up at this formula here, you will see that this little lambda has dimensions 1 over time squared and is related to this big lambda by a velocity of light thing. I've put it in here, actually, up here. So there is such a limit, and it's quite interesting to explore this limit purely mathematically and also in connection with cosmology. After all, if the universe is expanding and dominated by a cosmological term, but the expansion is not too fast and the things moving around it are moving around slowly, then the fundamental symmetry of the universe is in fact not the Galilean group, but rather this Newton-Hooke group. So there's a paper, I haven't written the HEPTH number, but if you want to read more about the Newton-Hooke group, it's in this paper with one of my current research students, Christophe Petrico. Okay, so that's a set of equations. Now, the argument used by Gao was simply he wanted to understand what a cosmological term could be in matrix theory, and so he said, well, if you have a cosmological matrix theory, then you should have some residual gauge symmetry, which is the cosmological version of the Galilean group, and he knew that the cosmological version of the Galilean group was this Newton-Hooke group. So, and it's easy to check, I'll say a bit more about that later, that this system has this symmetry. Okay, so now we're going to take this theory and think about cosmology. Okay, so to gain some insight, it's perhaps useful to recall the simplest version of cosmology, not often taught in cosmology books, but it's bona fide cosmology. So if you were Newton, you'd cross that term out and you'd say this is the equations of motion for the whole world, right? You've got a bunch of particles that are all gravitating with the inverse square law, and your task is to find solutions of this. These represent galaxies or something like that. And if lambda is zero, this is, of course, Galilean invariant. This system is clearly not Galilean invariant, if you put that term there. In fact, it seems to break translation invariance, but it, in fact, has Newton-Hooke invariance. Right.
I suppose that's a little different.
No, it is not, actually. I mean, in our paper, we showed that the Newton-Hooke group is an invariance of the PP waves. The isometry group of the PP waves with a uniform background is of the Newton-Hooke group, in fact.
So the matrix model written down in that context was supersymmetric.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this?
There is a supersymmetric version, I think, of this group by contraction of the ADS group.
Okay, so then that would suggest that that
depends on the sign of lambda, of course. I mean, if lambda is negative, that won't. You could, in principle, have a supersymmetric version. Yeah.
Right. So it would suggest that at least for negative lambda, that this matrix model describes zero brains, not precisely in the Sitter space, but in this PP wave.
That's a possible interpretation. Yeah, which we haven't explored in detail. But certainly what is true is that the symmetry group or this Newton-Hooke group can be understood in terms of PP waves. In fact, the treatment we give is a bit more elaborate than that, but it's fundamentally what's going on. Right. So, I mean, it's a slightly different lecture to talk about what I call Newton-Cartan spacetimes, but there is a kinematic framework in which one can understand this group as a dimensional reduction of a PP wave. Okay, well now, of course, you want to find solutions of this equation, and so we make a homothetic ansatz. We suppose that the positions of our particles are some universal scale factor times positions which are independent of time. So that's the same as the cosmological principle. Well, you can just substitute that ansatz into these equations, keeping this cosmological term, and you'll easily see, it's an elementary exercise, that to get a consistent solution, you need two requirements, one of which is that the scale factor satisfies a generalized Rayshard-Hurey equation. And the second thing that you will need is that the positions themselves satisfy this equilibrium condition. So a set of particles satisfying this equation are referred to in the mathematics or celestial mechanics literature as a central configuration. And I'll describe that in a bit more detail. But given a central configuration, given a solution of that equation, you have a cosmological model which represents the homothetic expansion of the universe and describes to high precision what our universe looks like out to a Hubble scale at which the velocity of light becomes important. Okay, so it's easy to check that these central configurations are extrema of a potential function. And we could call them ground states. Now, in the matrix model language, that's a mass term. And if we replace this by the matrix theory potential, then actually we'd be talking about certain ground states of the matrix model. I'll come to that in the next transparency or so. But let's focus on elementary Newtonian theory. So you've got to find an extremum of this, and it's not too tricky to find minima. Actually, to find all solutions is a difficult problem in, it's just technically extraordinarily difficult to find all critical points of this. But, I mean, the basic physics is very clear. The first term is a gravitational attraction between the particles. The second term is an entirely artificial repulsion, not coming from the lambda term necessarily. It's there even if lambda is zero, but it comes from the inertial term in our equation of motion. So the central configuration is a bunch of particles which are attracted one towards each other, but repelled by an artificial repulsion term. Those of you who know something about the so-called current Bunn model of the atom invented by J.J. Thompson, in fact, I did have an overhead, but I don't have it with me, of J.J. Thompson, will know that this resembles a problem in electrostatics, but that's a side comment from the point of view of the present discussion. Now, parenthetically, I'd like to remark that if you actually want to get a model of Newtonian cosmology like this, you can actually consider what happens to a large number of these particles. Now, it's pretty clear that if you've got like four particles, that they can form a tetrahedron or some such structure. And as you get more and more particles, it turns out that they form a shell-like structure. We numerically computed the system up to 10 to the 4 particles and found that the particles form a uniform ball whose mass and radius are related by this formula. Density is that. And it behaves rather like a fluid. In fact, in this way, you recover a pressure-free fluid description of cosmology. So the statement I'd like to make is, if you want to teach cosmology, as it were, without any general relativity, this is the way to do it. It's just an elementary exercise in Newtonian mechanics. The basic picture we're implementing here is of a uniform expansion of the particles in our universe. And this is how you do it. So it's a nice undergraduate exercise. Okay, so now what about matrix cosmology? We've got a bunch of matrices. Your first bet, your first guess, and I will argue later that this is not quite the right guess, your first guess would be, let's go for a homothetic solution. And this, roughly speaking, is what Alvarez and Meissen did shortly after the formulation of the matrix model. So you could look for equations of motion so that you get homothetic expansion. The world is a world of matrices. The ends of the matrices are the particles. The particles are in free expansion. And what does the matrix model tell you about that? Well, you get a Rayshard-Heary equation, but rather unusual, non-standard Rayshard-Heary equation, and you get the central configuration condition. So the same piece of mathematics goes on. Now, those of you who have studied the matrix model and its and also Yang-Mills will realize that this is, in fact, the equation for the vacuum of n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills with a mass term. And the sign of the mass term is such that the mass is positive if the cosmological constant is negative. So vacua, or solutions of this equation, are the analog of the central configurations, and then the Rayshard-Heary equation gives you the free expansion. Now, if you look at that Rayshard-Heary equation, you discover it has rather peculiar properties, and I'm going to say that, you know, because of this, we rejected this route. I'm taking you down a route, but it's a blind alley. From the Rayshard-Heary equation, purely formally, you can say, well, what's the pressure and what's the energy density? And you get the answer that the pressure is opposite in sign to the energy density. So this doesn't seem to be quite the sort of thing that one is interested in. But let's persist with it for a short while. It's certainly a legitimate solution of the matrix model. What about the central configurations? Well, to solve these equations, probably a lot of people know that you can, as one type of solutions, take three matrices living in SU2, use the SU2 algebra, and then you will get some solutions. In fact, here you're using a Casimir, so this mu has to take the value -2. So you're getting negative energy density in this picture. Okay, from the mu, the energy density depends on the mu. So it looks bad, but nevertheless, it's a solution. Now, of course, that's three matrices, and the world is supposed to be nine-dimensional, nine spatial dimensions. So there are different ways you could imagine of playing with this model. I mean, we all know that 9 is 3 plus 3 plus 3, so you could take three bunches of SU2 representations, and that will give you some kind of picture. And it's kind of interesting that 9 splits into 3 plus 3. So that's one approach. And more generally, following that idea and thinking about Bianchi cosmologies, you could just pick three scale factors, one for each of the three SU2 representations, and then you'd get some equations for the three scale factors. And if you put them in and they're all diagonal, you just get some exponential expansion. So it's like the matrices just expanding on you exponentially, but you can also put them unequal and then you'll get three dimensions exponentially expanding and six dimensions oscillating. So you get some quite nice classical solutions of this matrix model, and they're kind of reminiscent. They remind you of things that you may have seen in cosmology. Now, the matrix model was studied long ago, before anybody thought of it as the matrix model, actually as a reduction of Yang-Mills. And in those studies of the 80s, people discovered some rather interesting chaotic behavior, which is not unrelated to things that later became important when the matrix model was studied. So I'm going to take a little detour to describe the relationship between the matrix model and chaos, which is a sort of pretty subject. And for those of you who know a bit about Bianchi cosmology, you will see certain analogies between the equations of Bianchi cosmology and these equations. So in Yang-Mills theory, you could, and it's really just a transcription, so the reference for this, there's a nice paper on this, goes back some years on chaos. This is one of the references for chaos in the matrix model. You expand your Yang-Mills field out in a basis. Tau 1, tau 2, and tau 3 are the Pauli matrices, and then you've got this U, V, and W, which are functions of position. So you can now just write down Lagrangian for the system, and of course you get a kinetic term, which is what you'd expect, sum of squares, and you get a potential term. And the potential term is, of course, quartic, because it's really coming from the commutator squared, which is the standard way it would come. And if you look at UVW space, what you see is that this potential is vanishing along the axes. So you've got three perpendicular valleys. Those perpendicular valleys play a big role in looking at the ground state of the matrix theory, for those people who are familiar with that. And those three perpendicular valleys are the valleys along which the matrices commute. So I want you to think of those as classical directions. There's a kind of analogy here with radioactivity. So there are classical directions, and the system is rattling around. And basically what happens is it rattles around up this valley and up this valley and up this valley. And if the cosmological constant is zero, then it will never really get out. Of course, at the quantum level, when you add the fermions and so forth, as many of you will be familiar, the quantum mechanics of the system is a bit different. You don't have the... I mean, this would never give you a zero state, but zero energy state, but... we're not doing we're doing classical matrix theory here. We're not doing quantum matrix theory. Or we're not doing, we're not putting in the fermions. So you've got these three commutative valleys, and actually, mathematically, it's very similar to Bianchi 9 structure. If you put in a repulsive cosmological term, of course, what will happen is that the system will rattle around, but as long as it, after a while, if it gets sufficiently far along this valley, since the repulsive term is proportional to the distance, it'll whiz out. So actually, it will escape to the classical regime in which three directions expand, three commuting directions expand. So that's somehow the birth of a classical universe from this primordial matrix model. So that is a picture of the classical matrix theory. So in this picture, you could imagine so SU2 times SU2 times SU2 in the matrix model, it's just three directions expand and the remaining remain bounded. So that might be the view that you would say, that might be the message of matrix cosmology, but it's not actually correct. So this is what I, you know, when we started, I thought this might be a way of thinking about matrix cosmology, but what I want to now argue is it's certainly a legitimate solution of these equations, but it's not quite the same as the D0 particles. So I'm going to shift gears slightly now and tell you about what happens with D0 particles. So we're going to return now to a more supergravity-based picture. So if you have D0 particles, then we know that at the supergravity level, there are these extreme black holes. And we could have K clusters. So the K clusters are described by a classical solution, the details of which I won't write down. But what is important is that it depends on a harmonic function, and the harmonic function is a harmonic function on E9. So this is just the analog of the Papapetri's Magenta solutions, but in this dimension. And that's a harmonic function. It goes as 1 over distance to the power 7. And the mu's are basically the masses of the clusters. Now, in order that this be classical, you've got to have a lot of D0 brains here. So this is a big number, but it's quantized. And you get to n. And that number n should be thought of as the n of the n by n matrix at this position, x equals xa. So I'm slightly puzzled by I've got. This is a sum over A. What have I written here? Let's just check the. I'm sorry, the subscript A should not be present, of course, on the second X. Right, just delete that subscript. Otherwise we get garbage. Okay, so one approach now to the dynamics of D0 brains, which we are fairly familiar with, I think, is the moduli space approach. What I'm going to show is that that's misleading in this context. So the moduli space approach, we would say, well, the moduli space of the system is k particles in E9, and there's a metric on E9, and then they should be following that metric. The metric they inherit from the type 2A action, so there's some standard calculation for figuring out what this metric is. Now, in fact, many years ago, before this subject became popular, these metrics were worked out, and in particular, Shiraishi from Japan showed that the metric is actually flat. So the lowest order velocity squared forces are vanishing in this system. Actually, that can also be understood from the supergravity point of view and the D-brain point of view, and was subsequently. So your intuition might be these are free particles. So what is the cosmology of freely expanding particles? Well, if I have a bunch of particles concentrated near the origin and I let them expand outwards, then they'll just expand outwards. The forces are supposed to balance, and that's what we call a Milne model. Now, if we believed it was a Milne model, then we would say that the scale factor representing the Milne model should be proportional to time, and the relationship between energy density and pressure should be this one. Okay. So that's what your expectations are. But I want to argue that that's actually not correct, because we don't need to use the moduli space approximation. What I claim is there's an exact solution representing D0 brains expanding. So we can look at the exact supergravity solution and figure out what's happening. And there's a vital difference. So this solution was found many years ago by Mackie and Shiraishi. And they based their work on a rather nice paper by Castor and Trashin, who looked at time-dependent black holes moving in a cosmological term. So Mackie and Shiraishi studied a wide variety of cosmological solutions of supergravity theory. And what they found is that there is a sense in which you get a Robertson-Walker universe, but the scale factor goes as t to the 1/9, and the energy density is equal to the pressure. It's stiff matter. And I want to show you how that works out. So the idea of Shiraishi and Mackie, or Mackie and Shiraishi, was to study this typical action here. So the first term is the Ricci scalar. The second is a dilaton, which is put in. The third term is a two-form, with a dilaton coupling constant, so it's similar to some of the things I was talking about in previous lectures. And then there's a Liouville term here. So here's a cosmological constant, and this is e to the sum multiple of phi. Okay, so now you can try and find solutions of this system. And in fact, if the lambda term was 0, we know how to find solutions of this equation. these equations, there will be a static solution which represents static charged black holes of some type. But if lambda is not zero, then the solutions have to be time, or the ones that they found are time dependent. So they are a subtle generalization of, on the one hand, a standard Friedman model, on the other hand, a typical brain solution with harmonic functions. So the metric is like this. So H is a time-dependent harmonic function. So this bit is the time, and this is the space. And if there were no time dependence, and if that A of T, which has a prescribed form, were 1, which is a special case, we'd have a static multi-brain solution, or multi-black hole solution. So the harmonic function H is 1 plus this piece, which, when I say harmonic, it depends on the, well, it's harmonic. And then it's got the scale factor coming in. And I'm wondering if I can slightly improve the focus here. Is that better for people? Yeah? So the dilaton has also a power of the scale factor, and the scale factor is coming down here. Now the F field is D of A, and the A is also given by this time-dependent piece here, and this is a harmonic function. Now most of the constants here you don't have to worry about, and they gave quite a general discussion in their paper. Now, there are various cases which I'll draw your attention to. So one is P equals 0 and A equals B. Another is P equals 2A squared, and then there's this one here. This one has got an exponential expansion. This one turns out to be the original Castor-Trashan solution or generalizations of. Now, of these solutions, the one that we're interested in is the one that would come from 10-dimensional type 2A theory. So rather than dwell at length on the detailed formulae here, let's turn to that case. But I do want to emphasize that they supplied a nice set of time-dependent backgrounds with a wide range of constants. Okay, so the 10-dimensional theory would be like this, where very prescribed values for the phi dependence come in, and the metric that turns out to be the metric is this. Now, you can look at this metric in the case that there are no particles present at all. If there are no particles present at all, the dilaton is time-dependent. That is why the scale factor has the value it depends on the way it does. It's t to the 1/9. This is the analog in 9 spatial dimensions of what is called stiff matter. So you've got a time-dependent dilaton, and this is the background in which the D0 brains are expanding. Now, if you suspend the time dependence, which you can do by taking a certain limit, then you get the static D0 brains. So you give these D0 brains a radial expansion, and you get the full time-dependent metric. And I've written it down here. Now you see that this H has got T to the 8/9, I think that is. Bigger pardon, that's 16/9. So I apologize that these formulae are a little bit indistinct. There's a dilaton coming in here. Now, in string theory, the string coupling constant is e to the phi in the conventions I'm using. So the string coupling constant in this universe is dependent upon time. And it's quite interesting that it's getting bigger at bigger and bigger times. At t equals 0, which is a sort of a singularity, you have weak coupling. And at large t, you have big coupling, strong coupling. Now, the t-dependence here is also interesting because you can see there's a 1 over 8 here, And there's a 16 over 9, so that gives you 2 over 9. And you'll also see that there's a 2 over 9 here. Now, 2 over 9 upstairs cancels 2 over 9 downstairs. So what that means is if I'm very close to these black holes, they are independent of time. They look like static black holes. They don't notice the universe is expanding. When I go far apart, I notice that the universe is expanding. So that's the basic physics of this solution. This will come later. A few moments.
Are you implying that this is a solution of string theory?
It's certainly an exact solution of the supergravity type 2A theory in 10 dimensions, and Miguel has asked me what it looks like in 11 dimensions. I'm about to answer his question. It's not supersymmetric in 10 dimensions, but, as you'll see, some magic happens. Okay, so the physics of this is very easy. The Mackey-Shirashi solutions represent an expanding gas of D0 brains in a background dilaton potential. Near each singularity, the solution is seemingly static, and you only notice they're expanding by going to large distances, which is pretty much what we see in astronomy. You don't notice the universe expanding unless you look at galaxies far away, and then you see the redshift effect. Now, the Mackey-Shirashi solution is clearly not BPS because it's time-dependent, and so it can't have conventional killing spinners. But there's something a little bit suspicious about this solution, not least why could they ever find it? They were not looking for BPS solutions. So, you know, there's a puzzle here. But now I'm going to resolve that puzzle by moving up to 11 dimensions. Before I do so, I just want to dispel any illusions. I mean, this is not a physical model of our universe because these zero particles all have the same charge. We do not live in a universe where everybody has the same Ramon-Ramon charge. So one should still regard these as an analog model for what's happening in the universe, not the literal truth. Okay, so now we're going to look at the lift to 11 dimensions of our system. And from the questions, I think you're going to anticipate what's going on here. So let's look at the background, i.e. the solution when there are no D0 particles. So this represents a Big Bang solution of conventional type. It's in cosmology, we'd say stiff matter dominated, T to the 2/9, I think is the formula here. The Big Bang is weak coupling. Late times are strong coupling. And here is the formula for the 10-dimensional metric. Now we can lift this to 11 dimensions by using standard uplifting formulae. And we just turn the handle. And we have to put a prefactor here, if you recall, on the 10-dimensional metric. And then we add the extra dimension Z, which is a killing direction. And it also has a time-dependent piece because that comes from the dilaton, which we're reinterpreting as a gravi-scalar. So this metric now can be massaged. You can introduce some new time variables. And the formula is fractional power of t. It's easy to see. I mean, it's just a standard now manipulation. This z is what we're going to call x10. It's not actually quite x10. The metric you get is this metric. Now, this metric has these 9 flat directions, so it's E9 times a 2-dimensional metric, which you will recognize as the Milne metric, if you know something about it. It's a flat metric, but it's in Milne coordinates. What this means geometrically is that if we take 2D Minkowski space, then the big T or little t equals constant surfaces are these hyperbole. And you see, it's got an artificial Big Bang here. It's not really a Big Bang. And the direction of this coupling constant is whizzing up in this direction, so it's strong coupling as we go to the future. So this model resembles in many ways certain two-dimensional matrix models which people have been exploring in an attempt to understand string theory in a time-dependent background. Now, X10 might be taken to be periodic. Indeed, if you really wanted this to be the M-theory circle, x10 should be periodic. But if x10 is periodic, we are identifying points on these hyperboli. And what that means is that we will have some fixed point here. So the quotient is, in fact, what is sometimes called Misner space-time. You get some non-Hausdorff manifold. And again, that's been discussed a great deal in the two-dimensional cosmology literature this past year or so. So I won't expand on the full details of that. I just remind or inform people who haven't seen these calculations before that the passage to inertial coordinates in this 2D sector here is just given by these standard formulae with hyperbolic sine coming in and hyperbolic cosine coming in. Okay, so that is the background, and the question now about supersymmetry is rather clear, I hope. Flat space is as supersymmetric as you would want. It has all the supersymmetries you could ask for. And the Killing spinners will be essentially have constant components in inertial coordinates in the 10-dimensional flat space. But those spinners are not invariant under boosts. Obviously, they transform under a boost in the standard way that a spinner does. And so the act of doing the dimensional reduction, the act of looking at the theory in 10 dimensions and projecting down, has destroyed the supersymmetry. So the dimensional reduction does not commute with supersymmetry. So that is the answer to the question that Miguel asked. Perhaps he had already anticipated the answer. Let us now look at the full solution in this higher dimensional space. So we can lift the general solution by very similar constructions. So here's the solution, and I've written out the necessary time formulae. And as I said here, this is a solution which is time-dependent only over the full cosmological solution. So this is the 10-dimensional solution. This is a recapitulation of previous overhead. So now we do the lift, which is a routine matter. And these formulae are a bit of a mess, but here is the lift. And you've got the A field coming in now because we have the Ramon-Ramon sector switched on or Kaluza-Klein vectors switched on. So it looks a complicated solution, but it can be shifted by appropriate coordinate transformations. And the intermediate formula is given by this, which still looks a bit of a mess. But we can tidy it up. So at the end of the day, we take a harmonic function to be this. So h hat here is an introduced harmonic function, which is related to the previous harmonic function, but it's got the time dependence taken out and the 1 taken out. So h hat hasn't got the 1. Then you do these redefinitions of the variables, and at the end of the day, you get the metric in the box. Now, the metric in the box is actually a PP wave. It's a PP wave in 11 dimensions. So again, it's certainly supersymmetric, considered as a PP wave. It's half BPS, of course, not full BPS. But an important point is that the PP wave in question is time-dependent. The profile of our PP wave is of the following structure. H hat, which is time-independent and a harmonic function, and a prefactor of 1 over x plus squared. Now, that prefactor of 1 over x plus squared cancels, it has the same weight, same 2, as the dx plus squared. That means, as an exact symmetry of our solution, we can rescale x plus. Now, as you know, if you rescale x plus and rescale the inverse with the inverse factor x minus, that is, in fact, a boost in Minkowski space. So this metric, although time-dependent, has a boost Killing vector. And that means that we can do a dimensional reduction, and that's what we did when we got to the 10-dimensional model. When you undo all the formulae, we're going down on a boost Killing vector again, removing the time dependence. But because the boost Killing vector does not commute with supersymmetry, The reduction downstairs in 10 dimensions is not supersymmetric. There is no downstairs killing spinner. So that's the situation then with respect to these classical solutions. So what we've discovered is a setting for D0 brains expanding purely classically, and this is a reinterpretation, if you like, of an existing metric of the or solution of the 2A theory. Now, towards now I'm coming towards the end of my lecture, and I just want to make some comments about how you might go about the quantization of this process of this solution. And it's at this stage that we have to recall that when the matrix model was first introduced, there was a great deal of activity in relating the quantum mechanical matrix theory to the supergravity sector. And the aim of that activity was to demonstrate that the matrix model, considered in its own right as a quantum mechanical matrix model, could reproduce the interactions of 10-dimensional supergravity theory. And there was partial success in this respect. I am no expert in this area, but my impression reading the literature is that there were lots of odds and ends which were never quite tidied up. To lowest order, it seemed to work, and then there were some problems at higher loops. So D0 brains have a V squared term and a V to the fourth term interaction a priori. The V squared term cancels, and that can be understood both from the matrix model and from supergravity point of view. So that's no mystery. And some attempts were made to derive the V to the fourth interactions using quantum mechanical perturbation theory. And there was some success, as I say, at about two loops. Now, actually, from a certain sense, in retrospect, to somebody who comes to this from cosmology, or from general relativity, some of this work appears to be, in some sense, almost obvious. And why is that? Well, the point is that these metrics, when lifted to 11 dimensions, and a lot of the work was done in 11 dimensions, are of Kirchhoff form. Now, we heard about Kirchhoff form earlier in the lectures. It's a very powerful way of solving our equations. PP waves are of Kirchhoff form, and a key point about Kirchhoff form is that at the gravitational level, perturbation theory at linear order is exact. So you see that when we look at these from the point of view of 11-dimensional supergravity theory, the interactions are rather trivial because they are of this PP wave form. On the other hand, from the matrix theory point of view, this is not completely obvious. Now, what did people do in the matrix theory? Well, the matrix theory is a quantum mechanical theory of n by n matrices. And to work out the interactions, you just do Born exchange, essentially, quantum mechanical perturbation theory. In fact, people talked about two loops, but as you know, there are no real loops in quantum mechanics. It's just that they were organizing quantum mechanical perturbation theory in a convenient form. So the work I'm referring to is by the Beckers and various other people. I won't give you a detailed bibliography. So the key idea is, how do you do matrix perturbation theory? Well, you just consider running waves. It's a very straightforward thing. And then you just put in some Born exchange of lowest order. And then you get an effective potential by folding into the Born exchange graphs. So this allows us now to see what it is the wave function of the universe in this interpretation. The wave function of the universe is just these running waves for the matrix model. And from this point of view, what we're actually seeing in this particular context, which is different from the perhaps more complicated physical model, is that the wave function of the universe is nothing like the putative wave function of the universe, which has been suggested in the context of inflation or something like that. In fact, it's very classical, and And there's no question in this particular model of no boundary and similar notions. So that's as far as we've got so far. One can carry the discussion of the wave function a little bit further. I haven't time to do it now, but one can actually write down a wave function for this Newtonian model, which is also illuminating. It's a classical Newtonian model, and you can quantize it and find a wave function. Okay, well, that's about as much as I've done on this so far, and I'd like to conclude then. So the first statement is that homothetic solutions of classical matrix model do resemble, in some ways, expanding universes, but don't capture the cosmology of D0 brains. So they're an interesting model, but they don't really capture the cosmology of D0 brains. Exact solutions representing the cosmological expansion of D0 brains are available and have very interesting properties. If we lift these to 11 dimensions, the solutions are BPS. And the reason that they don't appear BPS in lower dimensions is because the boost-killing vector doesn't commute with supersymmetry. So you get this time-dependent solution. What we've actually seen in this particular model is that quantum mechanical matrix theory does reproduce the classical supergravity theory, but doesn't seem to give much insight into the wave function of the universe. And at least in this way of looking at things, I think it's fair to say that the status, or indeed significance or importance of notions like the wave function of the universe are as yet unclear, I think is the safest statement to make. So with that statement, I'd like to conclude my lecture. Thank you for your attention.
So we have time for one or two questions.
What was the role of supersymmetry in what you have been saying? I mean, was it just a relation to supergravity, or, I mean, where did it come in?
Right. Well, I think it came in effectively because the notion of a D0 particle is essentially a supersymmetric state. But the supersymmetry was not playing a, well, it's not playing a vital role in the interactions, and yet the fact that we could find, or more strictly, Mackey and Shiraishi could find these nice, simple solutions really was a reflection of an underlying supersymmetry in the 11-dimensional theory. But the choice from a cosmological point of view, this is not a very realistic model. I mean, the world is not a bunch of supersymmetric particles all the same charge expanding. So the supersymmetry is explaining why we can solve this particular model, I think. But it may also be reflecting what you need to do to make a more realistic model. So certainly you would need to think about a matrix model which was far from a supersymmetric state. Yes, indeed. I mean, the original papers of Shiraishi were obtained by taking this Lagrangian with a two-form. But in principle, that could be obtained by reduction from a brain-like solution with extra flat directions. Then one could go through the similar techniques. So I think the underlying message is that there's a large, probably, I mean, one would study their paper in detail, but there's probably a large class of time-dependent brain solutions of this sort, which can be constructed. Whether it's bigger than the class they have, it's not clear to me. But there's many time-dependent brain solutions could be obtained using their paper.
Regarding the quantization and the wave function of the universe, have you in your work already got any information regarding prediction on the or something that could be considered like a WKB expansion?
Right. Well, one thing that we did do is, am I audible, by the way, at the back? I think he turned off. So it's a slightly separate question. But what you can do is obviously quantize Newtonian cosmology. And there will be a multi-function, a multi-particle wave function, which will satisfy the multi-particle Schrödinger equation, which is quite trivial to write down. Now, actually, you can write down in the Hartree-Fock approximation a solution to that equation. And the solution is rather amusing. So it's the wave function for free particles. And I can't remember the detailed formulae, but they roughly speaking look like this. Okay, so we use the Hartree-Fock approximation. So it says depending on one particle, it depends on, all particles. It's something like psi of x is 1 over some power of t, which I can't remember. Let's call it n e to the I. And then it's something like x squared over t. I mean, it's just free expansion in some sense. Now, the point that's amusing about this from the point of view of the wave function of the universe is there's certainly no boundary, but if you let t goes to I tau, then this Hartree-Fock solution looks a bit like the heat kernel. So at this level, that's an observation, which I don't have a deep or profound explanation for. But it does underlie the fact that, rather surprisingly, although there's been a great deal of discussion of quantum cosmology, to my knowledge, very few people have just written down the Schrödinger equation for an expanding universe. It's not difficult to do, and it's not very difficult to solve. Of course, this doesn't capture the full dynamics of general relativity, but it might provide some intuition about what it means to talk about the wave function of the universe and how useful that might be. At least at the Newtonian level, the bottom line seems to be that it doesn't tell you a lot more than the classical theory. But as I say, it's a very truncated, mutilated version of the structure.
So let's thank Gary for his nice set of lectures again. And now, next, we have Matthew Hedrick, who's going to be telling us about the large n limit of C mod Zn and supergravity.
Okay, can you hear me? I can certainly hear myself loud and clear. So first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this wonderful conference. It's been a lot of fun, and also we've heard some good physics. So I'm going to talk today about a particular problem in closed string tachyon condensation. Now, I don't think that the general problem of closed string tachyon condensation requires very much motivation. I mean, it's, I think, one of the most pressing sort of open problems that points to our lack of a deep understanding of string theory in general. And the problem is made all the more sharp by the impressive progress that's been made in understanding the problem of open string tachyon condensation. Of course, in the open string case, what happens, as we've been taught by Ashok Sen and the work of many others, is that the unstable D-brains on which the open string tachyons live, when those tachyons condense, the D-brains decay away. That is, at the end of the condensation, they cease to exist. And then presumably, at least at long times, although the details of this process are not well understood, at long times, the energy contained in the D-brain, at least if it has some codimension, is radiated away to infinity. Now, given such a clean and clear picture, that sort of raises our standards for understanding what happens when closed-string tachyons condense. The problem there is much harder for many reasons, and I'm not going to give a full review here. But essentially, I mean, the bottom line is that when you're dealing with closed string processes, you're talking about the dynamics of the space-time itself, whereas open string dynamics, at least at the classical level, occur on a fixed space-time background. So just to give sort of the most extreme case of this, if we imagine some bulk closed string tachyon, like the bosonic closed string tachyon or one of the type zero tachyons, if we make an analogy between that and the tachyon living on a D-brain, in the D-brain case, the D-brain decays, it disappears, okay? So at the end of the condensation, there are no open string degrees of freedom left at all. Not just the tachyon has disappeared, of course, but it has taken with it all of the rest of the open strings that lived on that D-brain. So just by analogy, one might worry or imagine that the same thing might happen in the case of these closed string tachyons, that they simply take the space-time with them. We don't know whether that's true, but in any case, given that it's a possibility, it makes it harder to study. Now, at a somewhat more pedestrian level, and sort of at a more technical level, a problem with closed string tachyon condensation is that you don't have this tool that you had in the open string case, which was to tune G string to zero. In the open string case, that decoupled the closed strings, it decoupled gravity. Obviously, that's not going to work anymore in the closed string case. It doesn't make any sense to decouple the closed strings because that's what you want to study. I'm not going to tackle the problem of the bosonic closed string tachyon, type zero tachyon in this talk. I'm going to discuss a more well-understood case, which is this unstable C mod Zn orbifold of type 2 string theory. And I'm going to argue that we, from several points of view, we have good understanding, or at least prediction, for what happens when the tachyon in this system condenses. But that there's a lot we still don't understand that we wish we did. The first section is going to be a lightning review of old work and some recent work also on the decay of C mod Zn. In the second section, so in the first section, I'm really not going to tell you almost any details. Basically, I want to sort of refresh your memories or bring you up to speed on what is known, and tell you what sort of the main conjecture about this decay is, and try to give you the evidence we have for that. In the second section, I'm actually going to solve some equations which describe the late stages of this decay. The interesting thing is that the equations are simple enough that I'll actually just be able to solve them for you on a few transparencies. And I hope that that'll be somewhat interesting. It's not often that you can just, I'm not just going to give you the solution, I'm actually going to go through and show you how you get it. So it's not often that in a supergravity system you can actually do that. And then the last part is more recent work on some interesting things that happen in the large N limit. which actually I think the title that I gave to the organizers was The Large N Limit of C mod Zn. So that's what I'll end with. And basically what we'll see is that, I mean, of course, initially, the fact that you can't decouple gravity is a problem. It's at best a technical obstacle in understanding closed string tachyon condensation. And what we'll do in the second section is we'll at least in one regime sort of push that obstacle aside. And then in the third section, we'll actually turn the tables and show how we can use gravity to our advantage in trying to understand the system. Okay, so what do we know? So let me just describe this orbifold, since everyone in the audience hasn't necessarily studied this. Okay, basically everything I wrote in color you can't read, so I'll have to read it to you. This is one of the simplest orbifolds of string theory. You just orbifold by a rotation in, so you have type 2 string theory in 10 dimensions, you pick out two of the spatial dimensions and orbifold by a Zn subgroup of that rotation group. Is that better? Oh yeah, that's a lot better, thanks. N here has to be odd, and I'll explain the reason for that, but first just look at the picture. What this orbifold is a soliton. It's a soliton of the full, it's not a gravitational soliton because it doesn't solve, obviously, the gravitational equations of motion at the vertex here where you have a curvature singularity. But it is a soliton of the full closed string field theory equations of motion, which we don't know, but we do know that this is a solution. Because it does solve the classical equations of motion, because it is a good conformal field theory. And it's, unlike D-brains, it's a closed string soliton, so it's more like an NS5 brain, but unlike an NS5 brain, it's not supersymmetric. It breaks supersymmetry, of course, because this Zn, which sits in a U1 subgroup of the... in a U1 geometrical group, breaks supersymmetry. I mean, there's no covariantly constant spinners. So it's not BPS. Its mass you can calculate using the ADM formula. So it's 2 pi over kappa squared, where kappa squared is the gravitational coupling, times 1 minus 1 over n. That's just the deficit angle. And this energy is all infinitely concentrated, at least in this classical picture, at the origin. Even though it's not BPS, an important feature is that the supersymmetry is locally broken. And what that means is that only the spectrum of the twisted strings, which are the ones that wind around this fixed point, are non-supersymmetric. The spectrum of untwisted strings is still perfectly supersymmetric, so that if you move far enough away from the fixed point, far enough away that that where the twisted strings sort of can't get out that far, then you won't even know that supersymmetry is broken. So we have a system in which supersymmetry is locally broken. And given that supersymmetry is broken, it's not surprising at all that there are tachyons in the system. And basically the point is that this infinite concentration of energy that we have at the origin is unstable. It wants to get out. And the number of tachyons that you have depends on n. Oh, let me just say one other thing. Having supersymmetry in the bulk, having supersymmetry out here, is the reason why we wanted n to be odd. If you try to do it with n even, then you'll break supersymmetry even out here, and then you're dealing with a system with a bulk tachyon, which we want to avoid because we want to avoid the whole issue of whether the whole space-time will decay. Okay, so of course, since this is a Zn orbifold, we have n minus one twisted sectors. Every single one of those twisted sectors contains at least one tachyon, And this is the spectrum of the most tachyonic tachyon in the kth twisted sector. And it depends crucially on whether K is even or odd. But don't worry too much about that formula yet. So we have a codimension 2 soliton, which is unstable. And in codimension 2, gravity does not exert an attractive force. Of course, there's also no charge associated with these things. Gravity doesn't exert an attractive force in codimension 2. And so one idea you might have, I mean, there are several possibilities for what might happen when these tachyons condense. One possibility is simply that the spacetime rips or tears or some throat develops or something horrible happens at the tip here where the tachyons are localized. We have evidence that that is not what happens, that what happens is something much more mild. And then, in fact, what happens is that the energy flies off, it basically explodes like a bomb, flies off to infinity, and leaves behind flat space. Okay, what is the evidence? I'm not really going to explain this. I'm just going to go through what the evidence is. I would say the number one strongest piece of evidence that we have is based on world sheet renormalization group flow, where you substitute for the actual dynamics of the process a sort of a dynamics on the world sheet. So we know that anytime you have a tachyon, that corresponds on the world sheet to a relevant operator. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between unstable conformal field theories and between instabilities of conformal field theories and tachyons in space-time. And so you can exploit that, and when you have such a tachyon which corresponds to a relevant operator on the world sheet, see what happens when you actually turn that relevant operator on and flow to the infrared and see what you end up at. There's no theorem that says that this actually tells you what happens in the space-time dynamics. And it surely doesn't tell you literally what happens in the space-time dynamics, but it tells you what stable configurations there are close to the unstable one that you started with, stable solutions to the string equations of motion. But in any case, it's certainly an interesting question to ask what happens when you turn on these relevant operators on the world sheet. And a definitive answer to this question was given by Vafo, who exploited the fact that even though you've broken space-time supersymmetry, you still have world sheet supersymmetry. And what he did is he constructed a gauge linear sigma model on the world sheet, which doesn't, which flows to C mod Zn. But what it does is it actually flows to C, which is namely flat space, namely this picture. So when I say C, that's all I mean. I just mean the free conformal field theory. But it flows from the gauge linear sigma model down to this free theory, sort of stopping by C mod Zn along the way. And furthermore, the operator that's turned on in this part at the beginning of this part of the flow is precisely the tachyon vertex operator, or one of the n minus one tachyon vertex operators on the world sheet. So that's rather nice. In the description of the gauge linear sigma model, it's a little bit abstract. It's not obvious how you actually go from this thing which is a cone to something which is flat space. But you can actually get a picture of that by studying the one-loop beta function equations on the world sheet. Now, the one-loop beta function equations are, at least as far as the gravitational sector is concerned, what mathematicians call Ricci flow, namely the first derivative with respect to the log of the world sheet scale of the metric.